Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm a Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Adi Imasirovic, who's Senior Research Fellow at the OIES, and Kirk Chapman, who's an Independent Consultant. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from their paper, The Future of the Brent Oil Benchmark, A Radical Makeover, that was published by the Institute in early April 2022. Now, in this ever-changing world of our energy market, I think we need to timestamp this podcast. So just to let you know, we're recording it on the morning of Thursday, the 7th of April, 2022. Adi and Kurt, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Hello, David. Nice to be here.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me today.
Great. Well, Adi, you know, can I perhaps start with you with a bit of an explanatory question, if I may? The Brent market is one of the most complex commodity markets anywhere in the world. Perhaps you could share with our listeners, why is that so?
Brent market has grown organically, essentially, and the reasons are obviously historical. So just going briefly back to the history of the Brent market, it started with a forward market, which is at the essence of the Brent market as we see now these days on the screens. When the Brent market started, we had major oil companies with the upstream as well as downstream with refineries, and some kind of tax reference price had to be set up at the time. That induced companies to trade because when the tax reference price was above the market price, they would sell oil and they would keep it when the other way around was what was the tax reference price below. So essentially, this is an organic market that grew. It has peculiar a nomination system. When dates are nominated, that's when Brent becomes dated or Brent to dates. So we have this interaction between forward market, futures market, and dated market, which actually ended up in a number of derivative markets growing, such as contracts for differences or CFDs, dated to frontline or DFLs, exchange of futures for swaps or EFS, exchange of physical for swaps. So we have a number of these derivative things or instruments that are in effect very useful because they allow you pretty much to manage risk in anywhere within the sort of what we call a Brent complex.
Kurt, so perhaps I can come to you. You know, why is the S&P Global Commodity Insights, that of course is the new name for S&P Global Platts, making a change to the Brent contract? You know, I understand that there are only two cargoes of actual Brent crude grade being lifted monthly now, but what has been the evolution of the Brent benchmark since the commingling of the Brent and the Ninian fields and the introduction of the SUCO 1990 general terms and conditions? I remember that well because I was actually trading oil at that time. So perhaps, Kurt, you'd like to give us some update on that.
No, certainly. You know, essentially, with the declining North Sea production, particularly in what we now call the Brent basket of grades, which are Brent, Forties, Oseberg, Ekofisk, and Troll, alternatives need to be considered. BFOET production is currently only 700,000 barrels a day and looks to fall further. Historically, what has been done is other light, sweet North Sea grades have been added to the basket to increase volume. So in 2002, Forties and Oseberg were added. Ekofisk followed in 2007. And finally, Troll in 2017. Additionally, the window of crude oil cargoes that were considered when assessing dated Brent has been widened from the original 7 to 15 days, further to 10 to 21 days, 10 to 25 days, and now even almost up to 30 days when we call it a month ahead. Other measures that have been taken to improve liquidity were the consideration of ship-to-ship or STS transfers from Scapa Flow in Scotland. And additionally, in 2019, Platts started assessing SIF Rotterdam cargoes offered in the market when using to come up with their quote.
Adi, perhaps I can come to you. You know, WTI Midland appears to be the grade of choice for inclusion into the Brent basket. So why is the Midland grade of WTI stipulated, and does the current trade flow support that decision?
WTI Midland was chosen for three reasons: its quality, volumes and diversity of buyers and sellers. In terms of quality, WTI Midland with, well, WTI itself is for around 42 APIs, API density and 0.2 sulfur. Very, very similar to, for example, to Ekofisk, which is a North Sea Brent, one of the Brent basket grades. WTI Midland was chosen because in and around the Cushing, WTI itself, the deliverable into Cushing contract on CME, is basically very often blended from local light condensates and Canadian heavy grades. And it's not particularly popular with European refiners, whereas Midland is almost like has a clear origins and it's well recognized in terms of qualities. In terms of volume, volumes are large, up to 3 million barrels during 21, and well over 700,000 coming to Europe. And it's coming both to Northwest Europe and Mediterranean, which is very important to a number of different buyers. So it's certainly there in terms of volumes, quality, to provide additional liquidity required.
Kirk, can I come to you? Adding Johan Sverdrup to the Brent Forties, Oseberg, Ekofisk Control, or the BFOET seems to be an easy solution in shoring up the Brent basket. Was that considered? And if so, why wasn't it incorporated?
Well, let's start from the beginning. Johan Sverdrup, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'll call it JS to save my blushes. Was an oil field that began producing off the coast of Norway in 2019. And quickly, the volume was ramped up to over 500,000 barrels a day. The oil comes ashore at Munkstad, which is the same loading terminal as Troll. And it's even forecast to be producing over 700,000 barrels a day by the end of the year. However, the quality of JS is significantly different than the other grades that make up the Brent basket. The sulfur content at 0.8% is not dissimilar sometimes as 40s with the introduction of Buzzard, but the API gravity at 28 is 10 degrees lower than the other grades in the basket. Additionally, there are some concerns about market concentration. Equinor is the largest shareholder in the field. And if you include Equinor's equity position in the crude oils that make up the existing basket already, Troll, Ekofisk, Oseberg, there was a possibility that Equinor could have a very large and dominant position in the trade of the Brent basket.
So, Adi, what is the current latest proposal that S&P Global announced last month, and how does it work?
Just to cut it sort of to a nutshell, essentially the idea is to include WTI Midland quality into both dated Brent and forward Brent. Now, the difference with this proposal as opposed to the last one, which we'll probably come back to, is that this is going back to the basics, i.e. the assessments will be on the FOB basis rather than delivered basis. So the question, obvious question your listeners may ask, well, how on earth the WTI, which is offered on delivered basis in Europe, is going to be on FOB basis? Well, essentially, we just use some clever maths. We know the freight across the Atlantic. We know the freights in the Northwest Europe are really well defined. So you can take a number on delivered basis in Rotterdam, take the freight off to FOB basis, and add the freight from North Sea, but essentially as if the WTI Midland loaded in the North Sea. And then we have a basket where we compare like with the like, okay? The only other quirk was, I'll just mention it here and we'll come back to it probably later on, is that at the moment, the proposal for the so-called freight adjustment for WTI in the dated contract is at 40%. And for other BFOET grades is at 80%. Now, let me quickly just explain that. For BFOET, originally, before TI was introduced, was 80%, because it was seen that if somebody's buying oil on FOB basis, the buyer has a fairly good optionality. You can co-load it, you can sell it FOB, you can take it pretty much wherever you want. However, if you buy it on delivered basis, you're much more limited. So in a way, to compensate the buyer for that loss of optionality, this FAF, or freight adjustment factor, was applied across the board at 80%. Now, the fear for WTI was that WTI would dominate the whole basket, so they started with 40% as a proposal. And we'll come back a little bit to that, but it's very important to note that that's just for dated. For cash, there will be 100%, there will be no phrase adjustment.
Interesting. Well, Kurt, it seems to me that adding a delivered crude, in this case Midland WTI, and then netting it back to FOB seems extraordinarily complex. So what was the issue around the first proposal put forward by S&P Global in February 2021, and why was that rejected?
Well, the introduction of WTI Midland was not really controversial. Midland is a well-established grade with origins of quality that are known and is accepted by refiners globally. In fact, over 750,000 barrels a day of WTI Midland is now finding its way into Northwest Europe. But the overwhelming significance and therefore the opposition to the initial proposal was the change in the Brent assessment to a delivered basis, thus incorporating cost, insurance, and freight at Rotterdam prices rather than the long-standing free on board or FOB pricing at point of origin. Following that announcement, the dated Brent curve actually shifted higher because it was taking into account these additional factors that had not initially been considered to be part of the pricing mechanism. The modification represented a material change in the trading instruments that make up the Brent complex and potentially compromised the health of the Brent futures contract and the derivatives markets that are surrounded by it. And each of these instruments, the myriad of instruments that Addy had already referred to, have a very large open interest. So in essence, there was a worry that with this first proposal, market complex could collapse.
Addy, we've already talked about the importance of freight in the calculations, but from the latest proposal, it appears that the difference between transatlantic and Northwest Europe cross-continental freight is going to take an increasing importance. So my question is, you know, will the US terminals oblige by providing loading programs in a timely manner, just like the North Sea terminals do?
It's a great question and not an easy one to answer, but there is some logic to it. Essentially, first of all, let me come back to your first point. I totally agree with you. I think, you know, freight is going to be very, very important and will influence the assessment of the benchmark. So it's going to be extremely important. In terms of terminals, of course, currently, the players who are loading in the US Gulf terminals, they do have a fair bit of flexibility, obviously subject to sort of terminal constraints, that they can move the dates around and load when it suits them. So once the programs are published, they would lose that optionality. So the question is, why would they want to agree and load at these terminals? However, another very strong argument, and I think I've seen quite a few people in the market talk about, is that terminals would probably want that because by sheer fact that you can deliver your crude into major global benchmark, you are essentially adding value to your crude. So both from the player's point of view and from the terminal's point of view, it does make sense because the loss of optionality should be more than made up by the fact that you actually have this added value. You can not only just sell it in Asia and Europe, but you can actually deliver it into major benchmark.
Kurt, you know, it's interesting because I've noticed that the contract is planning to increase from 600,000 to 700,000 barrels. But doesn't this increasing cargo size reduce the number of North Sea cargoes available in the Brent basket?
It does and it doesn't. I mean, if you assume the current production of BFOET is roughly 700,000 barrels a day, if you shift from a 600,000 barrel cargo to a 700,000 barrel cargo, you're going to go from 35 to say 30 cargoes per month. So you lose 5 cargoes. On the other hand, if you're adding the WTI Midland program into the contract, you will gain an additional 30 cargoes of 700,000 barrels. So you net have an increase. Now, there is a slight niggle to that, which is the current proposal does not want to reflect the first seven or last seven cargoes in the corresponding calendar month. So you could potentially drop out 10 to 14 cargoes. But if that window and the anticipation is that window will be reduced to 3 days, you'll only lose 5 or 6 cargoes. So net, the expectation is that we'll gain about 20 cargoes into the BFOET WTI Midland basket, and therefore increase liquidity.
It's all in the numbers, as you say. It's all in the numbers.
Yes.
Addy, I've noticed that the freight adjustment factor, the FAF, will initially not be fully implemented in the dated Brent assessment. In fact, actually, only 40% of the FAF will be used in the calculations, while the forward Brent enjoys 100% inclusion. So is this a cause for concern?
Well, it is. Let me go back to the earlier point that I made on the sort of dated side of things. You know, the introduction for S&P Global, introduction of these alternative delivery grades is actually seen as a seatbelt. They call it a seatbelt. Essentially, it's not necessarily there to set the assessment or what we call the set the quote, but actually to put a cap on prices just in case the market gets squeezed as a result of low liquidity. So the idea of 40% is basically just to keep it as a kind of a cap to the existing market. The problem, however, and that's fine, is in terms of dated Brent is not necessarily a problem at all. The problem that I see there is that for the cash deliveries of WTI, which are a little bit more complicated, we don't have FAF in order to facilitate and sort of liquidity of the whole contract. But on the dated side, we have only 40%. On one side, we have 100%. On the other side, we have 40%, which means that the cash cargoes, what we call cash or forward cargoes, would probably be far more attractive than the dated cargoes. And the worry is that the convergence between the two and the convergence at the expiry of the contract really does have to happen, particularly for the futures contract. Futures contract depends on the forward contract. And if the convergence between two is kind of amiss a little bit, there could be all sorts of problems for not just for the actual futures contract, but some other derivative contracts like DFL and so on. So that's a worry. We just have to see how it works out in real life. But to be fair to S&P Global, they came with 40% as a just proposal, and they're quite happy to discuss it and change it if and when needed.
The message sounds like don't faff with the faff.
I like that. I do like that, yes. Well, look, as we get to the end of this podcast, you know, can I perhaps come to you both with a kind of forward-looking or strategic question? If the Midland WTI becomes the dominant grade in the Brent basket, why doesn't the industry simply abandon the Brent benchmark and move more crude oil pricing to the WTI contract? So, Kurt, would you like to give us your views first on that?
No, it's a very fair question. I mean, since 2015, when the ban on U.S. crude oil exports was repealed, WTI is essentially reconnected with the global market and is now pricing the marginal barrel in the Atlantic Basin. The industry, in fact, may well decide to move away from Brent and towards WTI as a benchmark. However, keep in mind that WTI prices at Cushing, Oklahoma, while the grade WTI Midland is exported from the Gulf Coast. You know, being a landlocked crude, WTI can be highly impacted by logistical constraints, be it tankage availability or pipeline capacity, etc. It wasn't that long ago, in April of 2020, that we actually saw negative prices in WTI. And that is a reminder that WTI still suffers from regional anomalies.
Well, Addy, why don't I come to you then and ask the same question? You know, why doesn't the industry simply abandon the Brent benchmark and move more crude oil pricing to the WTI contract?
Well, you know, it might well be happening, David. I think back in 2020, Bassam Fatou and I wrote a number of papers, and at least in two of those papers, we mentioned actually shifting of the sort of center of gravity of pricing towards the U.S. Gulf. But, you know, in when it comes to benchmarks, things don't happen overnight. At the end of the day, you know, benchmark is something that people are used to doing. And it's not necessarily the issue of complexity. It's not necessarily the issue of anything but liquidity, which people in the market tend to appreciate. So what is going to happen with Brent is a difficult one. I think most likely we need to fix it in the best way we can. When I say we, I mean the market. And then just see, and the market at the end of the day is going to vote with their feet and decide which benchmark is the best. And there's no shortage of them. As you know, we have now Murban in the Gulf. We also have DME. We have INE in China. So there's plenty of choice, and it's good to have it. So I think down to the market to decide what happens next.
Well, Addy and Kurt, you know, thank you so much for your time. You know, I really enjoyed our conversation. It brings me back to the days when I used to trade oil, when oil was less than $10 a barrel, I have to say. But anyway, but it also, of course, builds on the messages from your paper, The Future of the Brent Oil Benchmark, A Radical Makeover, that was published by the Institute in early April 2022. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity, or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org. Thank you.